Okay.
I believe we're recording now, and it's a pleasure to introduce Nils Chai, who is going to tell us about holomorphic vertex algebras of central 24.
Okay. Yeah, first of all, I want to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak at this conference, and of course also for organizing this workshop. So I will speak about holomorphic vertex operator algebras of central charge 24, more precisely about their classification. And before I start, I should say that most of the results here are joint work together with Sven Möller, or some of the results which I show here are joint work with Sven Möller. Some results are from other people. Okay, so let us start. So we will start with a short introduction where I recall Schellekens classification of the unimodular positive definite even lattices in rank 24. So Niemeyer's classification was the main motivation for my research over the last years, and it's also the motivation for many other people working in vertex operator algebras. So we start with that. Then I will explain how Schellekens and many other people classified holomorphic vertex operator algebras of central charge 24. Then I say a few words about orbifold theory, a dimension formula for orbifolds, and introduce generalized dipoles to you. So we have seen, or we have heard a lot about black holes. Today we will hear something about dipoles. Then I remind you about some facts from the Leech lattice. And at the end, I will describe what is known about these generalized dipoles and how they can be used to classify vertex operator algebras geometrically. Okay, oops. Then let us start with Niemeyer's theorem. In 1973, Niemeyer showed that up to isomorphism, there are exactly 24 positive definite even unimodular lattices of rank 24. And such a lattice is uniquely determined by its root sublattice L2. So the root sublattice is just the sublattice generated by the vectors of length 2 in L. That's the sublattice of L. And this root sublattice L2, that's an orthogonal sum of lattices of type ADE. And you can see the corresponding Duncan diagrams below AD and then E6, E7, and E8 on the right. And so you can, in this way, you can associate to your Niemeyer lattice such a Duncan diagram. And this diagram classifies your lattice uniquely. That's a very beautiful theorem. And there are at least 5 different proofs of this result. And let me shortly describe them. Niemeyer proved this result originally using Kneser's neighbor method. So what does that mean? How does it work? You fix some prime, and then you take any lattice in the above genus, and you calculate the P neighbors. And from these P neighbors, you calculate again the P neighbors, again and again. And after some time, you won't find any new lattices anymore. And then you have found all your lattices in the genus. Yeah, that's because we know that the neighborhood graph is connected. So in this way, you can find all the lattices in your genus. And this is a method which was used by Niemeyer. So this is the first proof. Then Venkoff found a very nice proof using theta functions with harmonic coefficients. The main idea here is maybe that you find a relation between vectors in your lattice and vectors in the ambient space using theta functions. So that's a very beautiful proof. Then there's a proof which is less well known, and it goes as follows. Well, the main idea is you can classify the dipoles in the Leech lattice and thereby classify the Niemeyer lattices. So this is something which I will describe later in the talk when we come to the Leech lattice. And then there's a fourth proof which uses the Minkowski-Siegel mass formula. The idea here is that the sum over the inverses of the orders of the orthogonal groups of the lattices in a genus is a fixed number which is well known. That means you can check whether a list of lattices describes your full genus by just summing up these numbers, and when you get the right number, then you know that you have found all isomorphism classes. This is maybe the simplest proof. On the other hand, you have to come up with the Minkowski-Siegel mass formula, which is a quite smart formula in my opinion. Then there is another sophisticated proof, which uses the classification of automorphic representations of O24. And I won't say much about this, except from that you can find this in the book by Chenevier and Lann, which is called Automorphic Forms and Even Unimodular Lattices. So these are the different proofs of Niemeyer's theorem, which are known. And this is a motivation for a lot of research in VOA theory. And we want to see that the classification of vertex operator algebras that we have at the moment, which is similar to the second proof, it's a bit similar to Venkov's approach. So we will see in this talk that we can have a proof probably which is similar to the classification of the dipoles in the Leech lattice. This is what I will explain, in my talk. Another reason why we started with lattices is that the theory of vertex operator algebras is in many aspects similar to the theory of lattices, but there are also some important differences, as we will see. Okay, and maybe just in case you don't know what a vertex algebra or vertex operator algebra is, don't worry, I prepared a slide for you. So usually people say it's difficult to describe what a vertex operator algebra is. Personally, I don't think so. So yeah, what is a vertex operator algebra? That's just a graded vector space together with a state field correspondence, which associates to each state, that means to each element in your vector space, a field. And this field is just an, this field has a Laurent expansion, and the coefficients are just linear maps on your vector space. Okay, so here you have the state in your vector space, this is some element in V, and you associate to this state a bunch of linear maps, and you organize them in these vertex operators. And of course, the state field correspondence has to satisfy certain axioms. And in addition to that, we have an action of the Virasoro algebra on this vector space. And the grading of V is just the grading by the L0 of the Virasoro algebra. Okay, so, and what we will do in this talk is we will study the classification of holomorphic vertex operator algebras, namely of central charge 24. So what does holomorphic mean? Holomorphic means these vertex operator algebras have only one module, namely itself, plus some additional regularity conditions, which are not important for the purpose of this talk. And the central charge is the action of the the number by which the central element of the Virasoro algebra acts. So these vertex operator algebras, the holomorphic ones of central charge 24, these are the analogs of the positive definite even unimodular lattices in rank 24. Okay, and these vertex operator algebras have been classified, or almost have been classified, by the work of Schellekens and many other people. And yeah, I want to quickly recall this classification, which is usually named Schellekens list. And the idea of the classification Yeah, I think it's easy to understand. So we start with our vertex operator algebra of central charge 24. We assume that it is holomorphic. That means it has only one irreducible module, namely itself. Then we can look at its V1 subspace. And this subspace is actually a Lie algebra. The question is, what is the product? For this, I go back one slide. So you can think of a vertex operator algebra also as a vector space with infinitely many products, these products A and B. Okay, and we take the zeros product here. So our V1 is a Lie algebra under the zeros product. And this Lie algebra is reductive. More precisely, in this case, we know automatically it's either zero or it's abelian of dimension 24 or semi-simple of rank at most 24. These are the three possibilities that we have. And yeah, let us consider the last possibility, the third possibility, that our V1 is semi-simple. Then we can write down the character of this vertex operator algebra. And by character, I mean our character takes the following form. So we have two variables. One is a tau variable, which measures the L0 eigenvalue. And then we have also the Z variable, which lives in a Cartan of V1. So V1 is semi-simple. We choose some Cartan algebra. Then Z lives in this algebra, and Z acts naturally in that zero mode on V, and we can calculate the corresponding trace. This is a character of V. And by the work of Chu, we know that this character is actually a Jacobi form of lattice index. So here is the first appearance of, or the second appearance of modular forms. So from this fact that this is a Jacobi form of lattice index, Schellekens derived 7 trace identities. Yeah, I won't write them down here explicitly, but you can derive 7 trace identities from this. And then you can put these identities on a computer, and after several weeks, the computer gives you 69 solutions. That means you have at most 69 solutions for your V1. Okay, and Schellekens now conjectured that each of these possibilities is realized by a unique vertex operator algebra. That's what he conjectured, and this was in 1993, so roughly 20 or exactly 20 years after Niemeyer's result. And it took mathematicians quite long to prove this conjecture. So roughly 2 years ago, the proof of the following theorem was completed. So we look at the holomorphic vertex operator algebras where the V1 space is non-trivial. Yeah, this case is completely solved. So there we have the 69 cases from before. And in addition, we have the case where V1 is abelian of dimension 24. So these two cases are settled. The case which is not settled is the case where V1 is just zero. So up to isomorphism, there are exactly 70 holomorphic vertex operator algebras of central charge 24, which have non-trivial V1. And such a vertex operator algebra is uniquely determined by its V1 structure. Okay, so this is the analog of Niemeyer's classification, and it combines the work of many, many people. And the proof is roughly, as it was finished 2 years ago. The case that V1 is trivial, that's the uniqueness of the moonshine module or the FLM conjecture. This case is still open, but the other case is now solved. Okay, so this is Schellekens' list. Anything more that I want to say on this? No. Okay, so now you know how Schellekens how vertex operator algebras are classified. So the proof, the idea of the proof is in some sense similar to Venkov's classification of the Niemeyer lattices. Okay. Then let us see what Orbi folding is, the dimension formula, and what generalized dipoles are. So yeah, we have seen how we can classify vertex operator algebras of central charge 24. Now we want to see how we can construct them. And one important construction is Orbi folding or Orbi fold theory. And this goes as follows. So we take a holomorphic vertex operator algebra of central charge C. Then V is holomorphic, then the C must be a multiple of 8. So similar to the lattice case, when you have a positive definite even unimodular lattice, then you know that the rank must be multiple of 8, and we have the same result here. So you take such a holomorphic vertex operator algebra, and we impose no restriction on the central charge at the moment, and we take some automorphism of finite order. And we also have to assume type 0, which I just wrote down to make the statement completely correct. So, so we take some automorphism of finite order. And we have one additional condition. So for each power of G, there's a so-called twisted module. And you have to assume that the conformal weight of these modules are positive for J different to zero. So when this is satisfied, then the fixed points of V under G, so this fixed point space here, this is again a vertex operator algebra, but this is no longer holomorphic. So this has more than one module, namely exactly n squared irreducible modules. And you can easily construct them as subspaces of these twisted modules. The idea is the following. So you have your twisted modules, and these modules carry an action, or G acts on these twisted modules, and you look at the eigenspaces. Now, when you decompose the twisted modules into eigenspaces under the action of G, and then you get these spaces W, J, K. This is how I called them. And now when you get, now you add certain modules of VG to VG to get a new bigger vertex operator algebra. And this bigger vertex operator algebra is now again holomorphic. So essentially what you do is you add to VG the fixed points of the twisted modules under G. Okay, this is the so-called orbifold of G. And this is now again a holomorphic vertex operator algebra of central charge C. And the reason why we add these twisted modules to our fixed points is that we want to have something holomorphic. Yeah, of course, we could also study VG, the fixed points, but this would not be a holomorphic VOA. It would have many different modules. Okay, so now we know what the orbifold of a VOA is. So we can, starting from one VOA, then we have some automorphisms at hand. We can construct many new ones. And when you do this correctly, you can, in certain cases, construct all other vertex operator algebras. For example, this is the case in central charge 24. And this is one of the main subjects of this talk. Okay, then let me continue. Also, maybe I should say something more. The problem with these orbifolds is that they are difficult to study, because in general, we don't know much about these twisted modules, except that they exist. So a question is, how can we get some information about these orbifolds? For example, an important invariant is the dimension of the V1 space. So what is the dimension of the V1 space? I give you an orbifold. What is the dimension of the V1 space? This is something that we can answer now.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
I think I missed the definition of type zero on that slide.
Yeah, I didn't give it to you. So
I guess what I'm worried about is what in physics are called modular anomalies, that you can have a something that looks like an automorphism, but when you actually try to construct the orbital fold, there are phases that come in defining the group action and the twisted sector that lead to an inconsistent partition function.
Yeah, but I think this is why we imposed the type zero condition.
So the type zero means, so type zero is no modular anomalies.
So type zero in a mathematical language means that the conformal weights of the irreducible modules take their values in 1/n times the integers.
Okay.
And
I think that's called level matching in physics.
Okay. Yeah, I'm. As you can see from the unfancy version of my slides, I'm a mathematician. So this is the condition that we impose. And then, of course, there are some ambiguities in, so what is, yeah, when you define your action on the action of the group generated by G on the twisted modules, there are some ambiguities. And what I say here, you can choose these actions such that that the orbifold is a vertex operator algebra whose structure extends that of the fixed point algebra. Okay, you can make such a choice that everything is consistent. And for this, we need the type zero condition.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, so now for the rest of this section, let us assume that the central charge is 24. And as I said, or as we know now, the dimension of the V1 space of a VOA is an interesting quantity, and it's not so easy to get to calculate it in general. And here's a nice formula which gives it to you very easily. And the theorem is as follows. So the dimension of the V1 space of your orbifold is obtained by adding to 24 the dimension of these fixed point spaces, and the coefficients C and D, they are given, determined by the system of linear equations, which I wrote down there. And then you have a correction term RG, which I could write down explicitly, which contains dimensions of twisted modules, which contains the dimensions of subspaces of twisted modules of weight smaller than one. Okay, so there's an explicit formula for the RG, but I don't write it down here. And there are some simple conditions which imply that the RG actually vanishes. Okay, so this is the dimension of a V1 space. And the good thing is the quantities on the right-hand side are easy to determine because the twisted modules are not involved. So the dimensions that we need to determine the dimension of the V1 of the orbifolds are just obtained by calculating the action of the powers of G on your original VOA. This is the VOA you start with, you have a G action. So this here is easy to calculate. So this is no problem. This here can be difficult, but in general, there are some nice conditions which imply that this is zero. And in general, you can also calculate this rest term here. One important observation is that this rest term here is non-negative. So this here is an upper bound for the dimension. Yeah, so we have an upper bound for this dimension. This is important. And this upper bound is reached when the rest term vanishes. Okay, and I think I want to indicate the proof of this. Actually, this formula here is an obstruction coming from Eisenstein series. So we had Eisenstein series already several times at this conference. And here's another occasion. So how do you prove this dimension formula? So you take, you define the abelian group Z divided by NZ to the power of 2. And on this abelian group, you define a quadratic form in the way which I wrote down there. So it looks like a hyperbolic plane. Then you have is what is called a discriminant form. Then we calculate the character of our fixed point algebra, more precisely the vector valued character. So VG, this VOA here has n squared modules. We calculate the character of all modules and put them into a big vector. Okay, so these are the characters of the individual modules. And yeah, we put them into a vector valued character. Then we actually get a modular form for the so-called Weyl representation. To be precise, it's a nearly holomorphic modular form of weight zero for the Weyl representation. So it's holomorphic on the upper half plane, but it has a pole at infinity. So the character gives you a modular form for the Weyl representation. Now we construct another modular form by lifting this Eisenstein series, which I have written down here. So this small f is just an ordinary scalar valued Eisenstein series for gamma zero n. Okay, and there's a natural way to lift this modular form to a vector valued modular form for the Weyl representation. And this time we take the dual Weyl representation. So now we have two modular forms. For two representations which are dual of each other, so we can contract or pair these two forms, then we get a scalar valued modular form of weight 2. And by the residue theorem, we know that its constant term has to vanish. So then we just do the calculations, which is a bit easier to say than to do. And the result is the following. So we get the first dimension formula. So the dimension of the fixed points of G on V1 are related to the V1 spaces of the different orbifolds in this way here. So this is the first dimension formula we get from the pairing with the Eisenstein series. And now we take linear combinations of this equation for different powers of G, and then we get the desired formula. So, if you want to phrase it very shortly, then you can say the dimension formula is an obstruction coming on the characters coming from the Eisenstein series. There are many other obstructions from other modular forms, not just from Eisenstein series. So you can do the other argument. You can do this argument with any other modular form for gamma zero n of weight 2. The problem is you will find expressions which are very difficult to control. So this function here gives you a very nice, this function gives you quantities that you have a chance to put your hands on. Okay, so now we can calculate the dimension of the V1 space of an orbifold, and this dimension is an important invariant for our VOAs. So next we want to define generalized dipoles, and I will explain the name a bit. The meaning of the name will become clear in a minute, but you see from this formula here, the case since zero is the lower bound for RG, of course it should be interesting to look exactly at this bound. When you have such a bound, you can ask what happens if RG is zero. This is what we want to do. And we call our automorphism a generalized dipole. If this rest term vanishes, that means that the upper bound in the dimension formula is attained. And in addition, we make another assumption. We assume, so our V1 subspace of the fixed points. So the right-hand side here, this is a Lie algebra. This has a Cartan subalgebra. Well, I should start here. So this, the V1 space of the orbifold is a Lie algebra, and it has a Cartan subalgebra. And we want that the Cartan subalgebra of this of the orbifold does not get contributions from the twisted modules. This is what we say here. Yeah, so the Cartan subalgebra of the orbifold does not get contributions from the twisted modules. That's the second condition that we impose. And the reason for this is that we then can control inverse orbifolding better. But that's not important. So we have these two conditions, which the first one, I think it's clear that you should look at this case, at the boundary case where the upper bound of the dimension is attained. And after some experimentation, you find that this is also a good idea to that this is all okay. And the next theorem stresses this. Okay, so this result also explain why generalized dipole is maybe a good name, because for the dipoles, they do what they should, in some sense they generalize the dipoles in the Leech lattice. So the next thing which you can show, which is analogous to Borchert's bijection between the dipoles and the Niemeyer lattices with roots, we have an analogous statements for vertex operator algebras. Namely, we have a natural bijection between the dipoles, and now dipoles are automorphisms. So we have a bijection between the classes of dipoles and the automorphism group of the vertex algebra of the Leech lattice. And we have this, in addition, we have this rank condition. So we have a bijection between these dipoles corresponding, also with positive rank, and the holomorphic vertex operator algebras with non-trivial V1. Okay, so we have a natural bijection between these two objects. Okay, and the proof is based on an average version of Katz's very strange formula. So, and this is a completely abstract result. Okay, and that means we can classify vertex operator algebras by classifying generalized dipoles. Only that the situation here is much more complicated, since the automorphism group of the lattice of the vertex algebra of the Leech lattice is of course an infinite group, and it's not so easy to determine the conjugacy classes. But this theorem is the basis for a geometric classification. Now, what have we done so far? We have shown that when you take any of the Lie algebras on Schellekens list, then we write down a generalized dipole such that the corresponding orbifold gives this Lie algebra. Okay, so the point of this theorem is this theorem here is abstract, and this here, also this theorem, this theorem here doesn't prove the existence of any VOA. Yeah, it just says when you have one, then it corresponds to a dipole, but it doesn't prove the existence of any VOA. Here we uniformly prove the existence of seven of the VOAs on Schellekens list with non-trivial V1. Okay. So, and I have to add here at this point, this is not the first uniform construction of these VOAs. Another one was given by Hoehn in 2017, which uses a completely different approach, which is based on coset theory. So in this way, we have a uniform constructions of the Lie algebras on Schellekens list by generalized dipoles. What is interesting in this context here is we have a natural projection from the automorphism group of the vertex operator algebra of the Leech lattice to the orthogonal group of the Leech lattice. So there's a natural map. And the automorphism group of the Leech lattice has many conjugacy classes, roughly 160, and you hit only 11 of them when you project. So, and the classes which you get, they depend on the isomorphism class of the orbifold tensorized with the hyperbolic plane. So this is something, as I said, the theory of VOAs is in many aspects similar to the lattice case, but there are also important differences. When you take a Niemeyer lattice and add a hyperbolic plane, they all become isomorphic. That is not the case for VOAs. Okay, anyway, so then, yeah, maybe I come to my last slide. So as I already said, the bijection between the generalized dipoles and the vertex operator algebras of central charge 24 with non-trivial V1, this allows to give a new classification of these VOAs. Oops. Just what do we have to do? We have to classify the conjugacy classes of dipoles. This is what we have to do to get a classification. So we already have shown that there is at least 70 classes. So the next step, what we have to do is that they are unique. And we are close to this, but it's not completely finished. But I'm confident that this will be possible. So, and how can we classify these classes? The idea is similar to Conway, Parker, and Sloan's idea to associate diagrams. So Conway, Parker, and Sloan associated Duncan diagrams to the dipoles, and we want to do something similar here. So one question is, where do we get the diagrams from? And the idea is as follows. So you take your automorphism, then you look at the fixed points under this automorphisms in your vertex algebra and take the corresponding V1 space. So you take this V1 space, this is a Lie algebra, then you take a Cartan subalgebra of the fixed points, and they act, so this Cartan algebra acts on the twisted module on the weight one subspace, and then you get weights from this action. And these weights actually form a Duncan diagram. This is something you can prove. And we think that these diagrams can be classified. So, and in this way, we get it. So these diagrams can be classified. And in this way, it seems that we get a geometric classification of at least of the generalized dipoles. Yeah, you can associate a unique diagram to such a hole. And in this way, we get a geometric classification of the holomorphic VOAs of central charge 24.
So by the way, we're at the 9-minute mark for if we keep on schedule.
Okay, yeah, I think I will be finished in a minute.
Sure, go ahead.
We haven't completely finished the calculations, but we are very close. So. I'm optimistic that when we have the next conference next year, where we can hopefully meet in person and have no problems with the technique, then I can make these statements a theorem. Okay. So this is maybe all I want to say. So the main points of my talk are you can classify the Niemeyer lattices by classifying dipoles in the Leech lattice. And it seems very probable, or we are very close to transferring this proof to VOAs. So we can classify VOAs of holomorphic VOAs of central charge 24 by classifying generalized dipoles in the automorphism group of the VOA of the Leech lattice. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Are there questions? Are there any questions?
Greg Moore raised his hand, Dan.
Okay. Yes. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah. Okay. All these vertex operators be defined over finite fields?
I think you can do that. You can define them over the integers, and I think you can also define them sometimes over finite fields. Of course, Sometimes it's possible, yes.
All right, so I had a related question then. So what about 24N?
So our dimension formula does work very well in dimension 24. For 48 and others, you get contributions into your dimension formula where you have no control of. We tried that. So the case dimension 24 seems to be special, at least as far as we can say.
Do you think there are a finite number of automorphism of VOAs of central charge 48?
I would guess, also if I should make a guess, then I would say yes.
Thanks.
So also what you can, a proof would be certainly much more difficult. So you could try to extend Chelykin's arguments to higher rank cases. In principle, you still get many restrictions from the fact that the character should be Jacobi form. But of course, this is speculation, but at least the modularity imposes strong restrictions, and that might be sufficient to prove finiteness. So if I should make a guess, I would say there are finitely many, but of course that's no proof. That's just a guess.
So I have a question, please.
Yes.
It's a rather general question. A lot of the background literature that you cited involved rather hefty computation.
Yes, that's correct.
Is your work just done by pure thought, or at some stage have you had thoughts to a computing device?
We used computers a lot as well. So we certainly also need computer computations. We need less computer computations than Chelykin's, but we also need them.
So. Can you indicate what sort of computations you're doing? I mean,
yes, I can.
It wasn't clear from your talk.
Yes, so for example, I give two examples. So one is we wrote down an explicit list of 70 generalized dipoles, which give all the elements on Chelykin's list. And you can make some educated guesses, but it still was used try and error. And so we had to verify some cases, and we did this on a computer to be quicker with verification.
I mean, I approve of the use of a computer, but it wasn't apparent in your talk that you ever needed one.
Yeah, I think we can almost avoid it. So, I mean, we can just write down the dipoles and no computations are any more necessary. This is something we can do. And, we used the computer to find these dipoles. Of course, when you have them, then you can do the calculations almost by hand. What you have to do sometimes, you have to verify that some characters do what you want. And for this, we had to calculate some theta. We had to calculate the theta functions of certain lattices. That's what we used the computer for example, in the verification that the 70 elements give the right Lie algebras. So yeah, I didn't make this very explicit, but at this point, we used computers to calculate theta functions, and we will also need them. So we classified the generalized dipoles in the automorphism group of the Leech lattice VOA to a large extent. As I said, we are almost done. And in this classification, we also used the computer. And this is when you look at Conway and Sloan's and Parker's classification of the deep holes in the Leech lattice, they do it by hand. But when you look at the calculations, then you see, also I would do it with a computer. So these are the two places. So I think, yeah, at least for the classification of deep holes, we will use computer calculations.
So I'd like to point out that we can continue the question and answer in the breakout rooms, and it's almost time for the next talk. So we might have one quest time for one quick question, but otherwise maybe we should continue this after the next lecture. Nils, will you be here for the breakout session?
I will be there for some time myself.
Let's see. So